Today we sit down with Muneeb, an information security consultant all the way from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. We get to discuss with him from everything from cricket to security posture. This was a fun one, Randy. I know nothing about information security or cybersecurity, but I love everything that goes into security. Kind of keeps the world running. And it's just interesting to hear from such a high-level expert like Muneeb. Give the listeners a little take from what you kind of thought about our conversation with Muneeb.
I think what I really liked about him, Thomas, was his common sense approach to security. I don't find often, maybe as a business owner, when people are presenting things around security, the practical aspects of it and how you can really be logical and yet be very business and revenue driven. And so I liked his approach. If you haven't listened to his webinar, it's on Experts Exchange, go do that. Very informative. Even if you're not into security, I think that if you have anything to do with technology, you'll find it very fascinating and worthwhile. So
perfect. Please enjoy Muneeb. Well, Muneeb, thanks for joining us today on Conversations with Tech Experts. We're lucky to have you.
My pleasure. I'm really grateful that you gave me the opportunity and for having me in your show. I'm looking forward to the discussion today.
Great. But I always like to start with our guests, just to give our users and our listeners a little background of you, your history of and technology, and we'll kind of kick it off from there.
So I actually, come from Pakistan, and I started my career from Pakistan working with one of the major telecommunication vendors. I worked over there on various projects, primarily in the telecommunication sector. My experience has mainly been in the telecommunication sector, but I came to Saudi Arabia back in 2010, and since I've been living over here, again, working with one of the major telecommunication operators over here in Saudi Arabia. Then I switched towards the information security side. It was quite, relatively, few years back. So my technical experience has been, it has more pivoted towards the technical side as I was, intricately involved with the various telecommunication projects and lately with the information security side. Just now, in the past 1 year, working with one of the major banks over here in Saudi Arabia, I have built a complete cyber threat intelligence function from the scratch. And this is one of the functions in information security, which is still in the infancy stage, not just in Saudi Arabia, but across the globe. Organizations are trying to, establish this from the scratch. And recently, I finished up writing two white papers on that. One of them was published recently in the month of June or perhaps in July, as I recall. The other one is in the review process. So that's about my background. Again, starting off from Pakistan and past 10 years have been over here in Saudi Arabia.
Great. Before we dive into too much cybersecurity talk, you gave us a little nugget that I want you to talk about a little bit is something I'm super interested in and have no clue about the sport at all, but cricket. And I think the only time I ever really see cricket in the U.S. is if it's a top play on ESPN and someone goes diving into the stands to make a catch, but I don't even know what I'm really watching. So talk a little about, you're saying you're a nerd for the game of cricket. So give us a little background on that.
Yeah, actually, anyone who is, we come from the countries which remain under, the British rule for a longer period of time. And cricket is actually restricted to the countries, to the Commonwealth countries. And it's not as, as popular as perhaps football is. So it's more played in the UK and Indo-Pak, Australia, New Zealand. So, it was natural that, and cricket is the most famous sport in Pakistan. So, when we were growing up, obviously, that was the natural sport that we wanted to play. And the superstars in Pakistan either came from the music industry or they came from the cricket side. So It was natural. You know, the closest sport that I can say, you know, in comparison to US side is something that you can equate to is the baseball. But I don't think that would be the right analogy or the right, you know, thing to basically equate, because there are significant differences in two, but on the surface, they look the same because you're smacking the ball, basically.
Yeah. Well, I don't know anything about cricket either. A little bit about the bat and the different plays that get made. Like Thomas said, you see the highlights on ESPN. The team. What's your team? Do you follow the national team of Pakistan? Is that your favorite team?
Yeah, obviously that, you know, that is a natural inclination for me to, you know, root for my own team. But obviously there are certain players who are, you know, doing extremely well on the international front. So, I mean, sometimes you cringe that why they are doing well against your team, but you cannot resist praising them because, I mean they are marvelous in their own field. So, there are players from UK, from England, from India, and even from Australia. I mean, so again, you definitely cringe when you see them performing against your team, but right. I mean, you can't resist praising them as well. Right. And one thing, I mean, to give you a bit more brief, so this game has three versions, basically. The longest version is played over 5 days. Wow. Every day, 90, you know, it's, I mean, 90 overs are bowled, and relatively smaller from a, you know, format is called one day, which spans for about 9 hours in a day. And the shortest format is called 2020, which spans for about 3.5 hours to 4 hours.
Wow.
So that's how it is. And I mean, the more you understand the intricacies of this game, the better you will understand. I mean, it has helped me a lot in understanding some of the, you know, lessons in life, especially about determination, because this is something that you see, I've seen in test cricket, because a team is down and out, and, you know, there you just have to grind yourself, continue to struggle and make sure that you are playing session by session, not thinking for over a 5 day period, just grinding yourself for 2 hour session, for another 3 hour session. So once you start winning the sessions, you basically begin to translate those wins, you know, into a longer 5 day win. So that is one of the primary lessons that I have learned from cricket is the ability to grind yourself and staying focused and determined. And I mean, there's so much that we can talk about it. You know, so therefore, I mean, this is one sport that I follow religiously.
Yeah. Well, I saw that I did a little bit of homework knowing that you were a big fan of cricket. So I know that the Pakistan team, I love that they're kind of their nicknames are the Men in Green or the Corner Tiger. I especially like that one, the Corner
Tiger. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, this one came from, you know, the person who happens to be the prime minister right now in Pakistan. So he was actually a cricket player himself. And this guy had coined this term, the Corner Tiger, because the only Cricket World Cup that Pakistan won was under his leadership. And back in Pakistan won its only World Cup back in 1992. And at that time, it was on the verge of losing the World Cup. I mean, it was not even qualifying for the finals. Nowhere in the race to qualify for the finals. But he, you know, kind of exhorted his boys to, you know, fight that and instilling in them the belief that, yeah, I mean, we are going to act like corner tigers. And he put on a T-shirt which had a tiger on it. So that's, you know, the background behind it. And the Pakistan team is also considered to be one of the most unpredictable teams. And therefore, many experts say that mostly it's their, you know, battle against their own selves. I mean, they mostly have to deal with their own selves. If they can defeat their bad side, they can defeat anyone else in the team, in the cricketing world.
Nice. Well, there you go. And then I also saw they were in England right now actually playing.
Yeah.
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 I see they're down the first match. They let go of a... That's the thing that's unique about baseball and cricket. They scored 107 points, they said, in their first go or their first at bat, however you say that. And then they let that lead go. So it was just interesting reading.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
Yeah,
well, absolutely. I mean, they allowed the match to be slipped away, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, good. Kind of still on the intro, I want to talk a little bit about how you came to EE, and it was from an expert that Casey kind of brought to our attention, that Matt Unix was like, "Hey, I got a cybersecurity star for you guys. Here he is." And I mean, Matt Unix has been on our site for a while, and now you've been on our site for 3 years. So how do you know Matt Unix? I mean, give us a little background on that.
Actually, 3 years back, I was studying again for information security, preparing myself for specific certifications there. At that point in time, I came across Matt Unix, and I found him to be extremely helpful. And since then, I still continue to study. I follow it more like a fitness regime. So back in I think April or May, I got the chance to discuss with him that I had certain ideas drafted in my mind. That was the space where, the time when I was actually writing certain white papers. And I wanted an avenue because I had certain other ideas that I wanted to contribute to. I needed some good forum. I had seen Matt Unix writing on Express and, Experts Exchange, and therefore, I discussed that with him. I was one of his regular readers at that time, but was not a member of Experts Exchange at that point. Then Matt Unix introduced me to Casey, and then I, got to know about Experts Exchange. It has allowed me to, share my ideas in a place. I mean, earlier I was looking for an avenue where I could house all my content, all the work that I was working on, or all the work that is in the pipeline right now. I'm grateful to again Cassie and Matt Unix, who actually introduced me to the platform and gave me this avenue.
Well, awesome. We love when other experts recruit other experts, because it shows, hey, there's something good about Experts Exchange, and if they're passionate about it, we want to make sure we capitalize on that. And this is a fun opportunity for us to talk to an expert like you that hasn't been on our site for too long, but kind of seeing the value, and kind of you stepped right in and started putting content up and doing a webinar and everything. And here you are jumping our podcast. So thanks again, and we're excited to have you. And let's kind of dive into the cybersecurity side of this podcast, and we'll kind of get going from there.
So, yeah, that's great. Thank you, Thomas. So looking at your material, one thing I found very interesting is how you approach your approach to security. And I know you talk a lot about the theater of bad actors that are obviously out there all the time. But, the other thing I thought was really interesting was your approach to being, I would say, very proactive in building up an armor to really not just take a defensive position or a position that allows you to just react when you have a problem, but really being proactive. And I being the owner of a company and obviously, dealing with different cyber threats and different things like that, maybe we could just start by you giving us a little bit of, some of the high level things that you're going to want people to take away from this podcast. If they take a few things away, what would that be that they could really take back to their company? I think that would be important, and I would like to hear that. I've read a lot of your material, and so I think I have a pretty good idea, but I'd just like to hear it from you, what your thoughts are on that.
One of the major challenges, as you mentioned, yourself, that if an organization, or even put it in the form of an individual, you cannot afford to remain in the firefighting mode all the time. You need to develop that capacity that, let's say, if there happens to be any incident, you should be alarmed prior to that. And that goes, and that is not specific to cybersecurity. That's how, individuals, that's how sound individuals, societies, and even organizations are supposed to function, because they are entrusted with some, with the resources that they have been provided. And so therefore, they have to be proactive. They have to erect those mechanisms in place within their organizations where they are able to act upon anything which is going to affect, the creation of value. Every organization exists due to the purpose that it has to create certain value. If anything happens that prevents that organization from creating that value, what happens is that it affects its revenue stream basically. Right. So in order to make sure that your revenue stream is continuous in nature, you need to establish those mechanisms which allow you to remain proactive rather than, you know, indulging in the firefighting all the time. So that is where, you know, I have, specifically, I have my expertise towards the sample threat intelligence, that once you understand that who are the folks who are operating and what is their modus operandi, that helps the organizations and even, you know, the government sector to establish the mechanisms within their orbit to prevent something malicious or something, rather obnoxious from occurring within their organizations or within the society.
Right. Well, one of the terms I liked that you used was having a secure posture. And I don't know if that's something I've ever heard before, somebody describe as your cyber intelligence policy. And so I think that, maybe explain that a little bit more if you would, that secure posture, because I found that really fascinating.
Yeah. So the thing is that, you see, the security by itself, what it does is that it tends to, put it this way, that the purpose of a security is to actually make sure that whatever processes are being done or whatever business processes are being executed, they are being executed in a safe manner. Okay. So every control that you put in place, to put it in the simplest of manner so that the audiences to who do not necessarily understand cybersecurity. Let's say if I have a house, okay, I won't put my crown jewels right at the entry. Okay, let's say I have a lot of gold, which I don't have, and a lot of money in my house. I would want to make sure that that stuff is placed with the appropriate security. So what tools will I bring in? What tools will I incorporate? So the set of tools that I will incorporate to prevent my crown jewels, those will establish my security posture. So let's say I would want to put in a sound lock at the entrance. And then I would want to make sure that there are multiple layers in between so that a person has to compromise multiple security controls. Maybe if he breaks into the main gate, he should not be able to break into the subsequent gates to get to my, let's say, to my bedroom and have access to my crown jewels. So I'll have to put in place all the controls, either in the form of vault or through certain locks, to make sure that even if he gets in over there, he has to, struggle immensely to get to my crown jewels. So every control that I, put in place, every layer of security that I put in place, all these layers basically contribute to the security posture. And they actually ensure that your organization is safe enough. And when you're dealing in cybersecurity, when you're dealing with the threat actors or simply say bad guys, basically it's the race against time, how quickly you are able to, hold onto those guys. I mean, put it this way, if God forbid, if someone comes into my house doing the robbery, I would want to make sure that the guy is caught and does not run away. That's the ultimate goal. And same goal happens with the organizations as well, that, they want to make sure that whoever has done some malicious activity or has impacted their value stream, that guy is actually caught. That group is actually taken care of by the law enforcement agencies. So in order to do that, you put in place certain layers of security controls. They can be, from physical security controls, again, put it this way, in the form of fences, in the form of locks, in the form of walls, and they can be in the form of technical controls, put it firewall, put it switches, intrusion detection systems. And then you have certain policies and procedures as well, that who will have access to the vault, which contains the actual valuable item that your organization depends upon. So all these controls together create a security posture. And again, that varies from organization to organization.
Right. Well, thank you. So I know that companies, I would say every company is going to say security to them is very important. Now, whether or not they act on that is another
thing, correct? So I think talking about their responsibilities, what would you say are some major challenges that the security leadership face in a company?
You know, one of the fundamental challenges that they have is that, you know, even though, let's say, if among the C-level executives, if the first thing is that how they have to create a buy-in, because security on its own does not generate the revenue stream. It does not translate into a financial bottom line that everyone is after, basically. Right. What it does is that the best that it, you know, shows you is that nothing adverse had happened. That is a reflection of your security controls working. So let's say if you want to bring in a fancy firewall that you intend to, through which you intend to protect your organization, you would want certain budget to be allocated from the CFO side. Obviously, securing that budget is extremely difficult because CFOs, they are non-technical people. They have valid concerns. They have definitely valid concerns because they are entrusted with the financial resources. But then as security leadership, you have to convince them why a particular control is important. So when it comes to security leadership, it is their immediate challenge is that how they carefully allocate the budget which is assigned to them. Where do they spend the money? I mean, if you are spending, you know, money in, let's say, just to protect some valuable item that has a value of $5,000. I won't be putting in a lock of $6,000. I mean, because the value of the security control itself is higher than the item that I intend to protect from it. So that is the fundamental challenge that they have. And in order to deal with this challenge, the main, ammunition that they have in their armory is the risk management tool. Therefore, using a risk-based approach, what they do is that they try and allocate their resources. They first try to understand that where the actual risk lies and what whether that risk falls within their appetite or not. If it does not, then they have to obviously allocate the resources towards that to counter that risk. And that is where, you know, the challenge begins, that the allocation of the budget in the correct manner, and then performing the risk assessment in a proper manner so that whatever will be the output of your risk management, that will determine where you will be spending your money.
Right. Well, one thing I found interesting and I really liked how you put the when you develop these plans and have a secure posture and you're doing all these things, that you're not trying to create friction or hinder the goals of the organization, because ultimately the goal of the organization is to make money, correct? And so if you're a hinder to that, you're really not doing your job. And I really liked how you put that. And how you understand that. And so I think that's really, really important to...
You know. This is one of the fundamental challenges, for us as information security consultants, that, and most of the information security consultants still gravitate because it's perhaps in their nature to apply a multitude of security controls, which again, kills the business velocity. That is not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to provide an enabling environment where these business operations continue to create the value. Because if the revenue stream is not working properly, then there's no point in having the security controls. So therefore, there has to be a structured and a balanced approach based again on the risk assessment that you are performing.
Right. The other thing I found very interesting that you mentioned was understanding the value of your assets that could be stolen, whether tangible or intangible, and actually how you would go about finding the value. And explain how you would go out and find the value, because I was like, wow, you're going to have to go places maybe that people don't usually go out on the web, correct?
First, the assets can be in the form of tangible and in the form of intangible assets. And again, the major ammunition that you can use to ascertain their value is through the risk assessment itself. So sometimes, let's say a server itself is, it's, onboarding cost is much lesser than the cost that would that you will have to incur if that server stops from working, because that server is actually generating the revenue for you. You're you know, lending the services to someone else, to let's say to the end users, and through that you are generating the money. So if that server for some reason goes down, what happens is that your revenue stream is basically affected. Your revenue chain is basically affected. So therefore, it has to be, again, the thing is that how you structure your, or how you configure your security controls to make sure that your that your revenue continues to come in, and you are able to, you know, pursue your business objectives.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it almost sounded like sometimes you're going to have to go out and into like dark web type scenarios to really understand what value there is for things that are being stolen, right?
Absolutely. So, you know, partly, and that is one of the critical parts, because, you know, one of the fundamental issues that I had mentioned was that security, you know, consultants, they tend to have perceptions of risk. Something that, and you know, these perceptions of risk that I often talk about is, it's not unique only to the security arena. This is something that we have seen in general. I'll give you an example. Coming from Pakistan during the COVID phases, there was you know, a discussion on, you know, enforcing a stern lockdown, and the government adopting a policy of having a smart lockdown, something that they call, so that they could balance between the livelihoods and the lives itself. So there has to be a balanced approach. So the point is that, you know, whenever you treat one risk, sometimes, you know, it gives birth to another risk. And sometimes a multitude of low-level risks, they aggregate to create a bigger risk for you. So in this case, basically what happens is that you, the problems that you identify from this, you know, observation is that oftentimes information security consultants, they tend to fall prey to the misperceptions. And once they fall prey to the misperceptions, they tend to estimate the risk incorrectly. How do you ascertain that your estimations are correct? Whatever estimations you have made, first thing is your assertion that, yeah, this risk may have materialized. If that materializes, what would be the financial effect? For that, you can leverage the intelligence coming back. This is the answer to the question that you asked. So in order to resolve this issue of perceptions, you can leverage the intelligence from the intelligence companies that are providing these the cyber threat intelligence services to the you know, to the customers. By having this intelligence fed to you in a structured manner, you are able to first ascertain whether your fears are genuine or not. If they are genuine, then are your estimations correct or not? How, I mean, should you be allocating as much budget as you intend to? Again, so this basically tends to resolve the problem that I had earlier spoken of.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I really like that. Yeah, it sounds like, are there any other challenges to risk perception that you think we haven't covered?
Yeah, so the first thing that I have mentioned is that, you know, risk perception, you know, it tends to create the fundamental thing that we need to understand is that whenever you treat one risk, it often tends to, and think of it, try to relate it with the common life as well. I mean, when you take one medicine, every medicine has its side effects also. Right. I mean, so it's, you have to perform a cost-benefit analysis whether, okay, I'm taking this aspirin, how does this suit me, or would it trigger another set of risks? The same thing happens in the information security arena, that when you're treating one risk, when you're mitigating or, let's say, responding to a particular risk, it tends to crop up another risk. And sometimes what happens is that you are focusing more on the higher risks that organization really cares about, but the smaller risks aggregate, and then they create the aggregated effect of those smaller risks is as colossal in nature as the one that you initially intended to attend to. So that's the first issue of misperception. Then this misperception gives birth to another issue, which is the estimation. How accurate are your estimations? Because if your estimations are incorrect, what will happen is that your security leadership won't be able to allocate the budget in an intelligent manner. So again, you see that the problem is actually compounding. You're not resolving the issue, your problems are getting compounded. And that's where your cyber threat intelligence can help your organization in making sure that you allocate your budgets appropriately. It helps you in ascertaining your, whether the concerns or the fears that you have, are they valid or not? And then also how much you should be caring about those fears or concerns.
Right. When you're working with a company, how open are companies to integrating their cyber threat intelligence with risk management function? Like, what do you see there? Is that a struggle to integrate those two and get those two well together?
Right now, cyber threat intelligence itself as a function is in the infancy stage. Still organizations are struggling to establish it as a function. We conceived this function back last year in June or something. And then we had had a complete structured approach. Now we are in the phase where we are integrating this with the risk management function. But again, this is an idea which is still in the embryonic stage. This will take certain time. So first, your cyber threat intelligence function itself has to be mature enough to provide those reports those inputs to the risk management function. Because again, if your cyber threat intelligence function is not mature enough, what will happen is that you'll be providing the wrong, and you'll be feeding the risk management function with the inaccurate information, and then you will be compounding the problem further rather than resolving it. As we speak, organizations are currently trying to onboard the cyber threat intelligence function with especially in this part of the world, in the Asian continent. They're trying to onboard it. And as I foresee, in probably years' time or so, they will begin to incorporate it with the other functions. Risk management is one. So, and the other functions are, fraud prevention. Vulnerability assessment is another function that it can feed to. So, since this is in the initial stages, as you move ahead, as the technology matures, as the solutions mature, it will start providing inputs to the other functions as well.
Right. Another thing that you said that ties into this that I really liked is that you do not have to go blindly into your approach and how you approach cyber intelligence. That you can, there's visible patterns, observations that you can make, and you can look at what's happened. I really thought that was a good, the way you're approaching that. I think you were using you had a model you were using to kind of go through that cycle. Talk a little bit about that, how a company doesn't have to go blindly into intelligence.
So, when you are acquiring the threat intelligence services, so there are multiple players out there who are providing these threat intelligence services. So you first need to understand that what are your own business drivers? What do you really care about?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's say if I am operating in a financial sector, perhaps the risks that I am facing, maybe those risks will not be, maybe the company that I intend to work with may not be able to provide me the threat intelligence about those risks. So whenever you are selecting the partners, so it has to be a considerate approach. You have to ascertain the capabilities and the service offerings and understand that basically what this particular partner is capable of providing, what kind of intelligence this provides. So there are threat intelligence providers who excel in malware intelligence, because malwares act as a tool to infect the organizations with and to disrupt their business operations. And then there are certain, you know, providers who provide the adversary intelligence, that who are the threat actors who are at play. Then there are certain, you know, providers who provide, who excel and provide in serving the needs of the financial industry. So you have to first understand that what are your business drivers and what the kind of information do you really need from them. And then based on that, you need to partner with them and then see, and obviously as you partner with them, you need to spell out clearly that what you will be expecting from them. And then try to you know, have that information in, you know, coming into your system and into your subsequently into your functions, including risk management function itself.
Well, and I also think that, you know, you mentioned dynamic threats as well, and that's something that I think can get very complicated. And maybe you can just, we can talk a little bit about how you see dynamic threats and how you would handle those and approach those.
Yeah, there's something that I call threat actor attribution. So, and, you know, the more we relate it with our common lives, the easier it will be for us to understand. You see, in every society, basically, in every society, you have smaller thieves and there are bigger gangs.
Yeah.
Okay. So sometimes what happens is that those big gangs cannot do every stuff on their own, or they don't want to have their hands dirty. Mm-hmm. So basically the smaller players become their accomplices and they outsource their portion. The bigger gangs outsource their portion of the work to the smaller thieves. They do that dirty work and, you know, provide the initial, what they call basically low hanging fruits. And those low hanging fruits basically provide the bigger gangs, the actual, you know, the determined actors, the capacity to actually, you know, cause the bigger damage. The other thing is that you need to first understand that, you know, even in a normal society, there are people who do something wrong, either due to opportunity because they got the opportunity, or there are people who are determined to do wrong. That these are the two basic classifications in any society. Pick up any society in the world. So there might be people who, I mean, who stay within their boundaries, but I mean, they deviate once they get the opportunity to do something wrong. Same thing happens in the cyber threat landscape. Basically, there are threat actors who are driven by opportunity. They got the chance to exploit certain organizations. They exploited that. And then they cannot do anything further than that. So let's say if I am a threat actor, if I only have the capacity to infect one small organization, and but not you know, go after bigger organizations, probably I would, you know, infect those organizations and put that you know, compromised servers sale for access, and maybe some bigger players would be interested in having that access to those servers. So this is how basically this you know, society works. Basically, this is how they work together in a collaborative manner. I mean, imagine that the fundamentals don't change, basically, of collaboration, whether the you are collaborating in the right direction or in the wrong direction.
Yeah. I definitely, you know, as I think about just the different threats that we have and that we're facing, one of the things I've always felt pretty strongly in is that our greatest threat from a terrorist threat is going to come in our financial districts. That's something that I've always thought, because I thought, wow, if our financial markets were shut down, that would really, I mean, I know this coronavirus has definitely thrown a wrench in the world economy and things, but you still see markets functioning well, and they're feeling, it looks like to me, there's a lot of confidence in the markets and things going on, but yeah, you shut that down. I'm just curious, now that you work with banks, how do you feel about that, and how do you feel like we are prepared to handle such threats?
You know, again, this has a lot to do with the security posture that we were referring to in the start. That basically the disaster does not occur in a night. So let's say, I mean, one of the examples that I give is that let's say if someone intends to rob a bank. And if he decides to rob a bank at night and goes in the morning to rob a bank, what will happen is that this guy will eventually end up in jail by the morning. So this guy, so the, you know, the robbers have to do a lot of reconnaissance activity over a period of 3 months to 4 months. And then there has to be, you know, there a lot of security controls have to be missing in that bank in order for those robbers to actually get in and then get out, because their strategy is not just to get inside into that bank, but also to get out. Same thing happens basically that, you know, these security controls, as long as they are resilient enough, and in cybersecurity, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. It will happen, but again, it all boils down to how resilient your mechanisms are to protect yourself from something that is, you know, at the higher spectrum of adversity. Basically, if you can guard yourself. So organizations are dealing with lower level kind of attacks, but for a serious nature of attack to materialize, an organization would have a multitude of controls that would be missing from the organizational security posture, due to which an organization would actually crumble and you know, be a victim of a cyber attack, especially in the financial market.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would like to, if people are going to take one thing away from this podcast, what would you like them to take away and start thinking about or act on even?
You know, one of the things that whatever I write is that collaboration is actually, something that I see missing still right now. Cybersecurity itself, I mean, if it continues to function in silos, it will never be able to, organizations will never be able to reap its true benefits, because there are, the business operations and cybersecurity are still at odds, because their roles are actually conflicting in nature. So let's say, to put it simply, maybe certain customers would not want, to have one-time password delivered to their phones in order to carry out any financial transactions. However, the security guys would want to have those controls in place in order to make sure, in order to prevent the fraud from occurring. So the two divisions are often at odds with each other. The solution is that you have to understand the other person's perspective and strike a middle ground. And that can only be done when you have a collaborative approach. And with the collaborative and with the roots of cybersecurity, becoming part of different business functions, that is when actually we'll be able to reap its benefits truly.
Right. Well, I like when you talk about collaboration and the strength of that and the importance of that, because that's obviously what Experts Exchange really at the heart of it is all about, is people coming in, peers, collaborating, with other colleagues on high-level ideas and thoughts and challenging each other and challenging those thoughts. So I think that's really great. Well, Muneeb, thank you for, one, being a thought leader in this cyber threat intelligence area, and really, just giving us some insight to security and how to think about it on this global stage. And I think I really appreciate your time and just your intelligence on this matter. And I think I find it fascinating, and I'm not even in security, but it is fascinating to listen to how you think and your thoughts about it. And I just, I thank you for doing that. So
my pleasure. It was indeed valuable. Yeah. I mean, I look for such, sessions where I can share my insight. Most of the work that I have done, I still have certain proteges that I hope they will, transform into thought leaders again. This being one of my personal, I feel close affinity to this particular topic, and so therefore, back in April or May, I thought about writing on it too much, and since I had already implemented this function itself, so therefore, this thing came naturally to me. And I definitely look forward to similar collaborations even with Experts Exchange in future.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I also want to give a shout out to Mad Unix for connecting us with you and giving us and our community access to your knowledge. It's a real honor to have experts like him to keep growing that security side on Expert Exchange. So thanks to Mad Unix, and
Muneeb, thank you so much for taking time and sitting with us. And I know our users are going to love listening to this. So again, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.